So I think we can start whenever you're ready. Oh, I'm starting. I guess we'll start whenever I'm ready. Hi, I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Grantz.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
And today we're going to ruin the apocalypse.
Specifically the disease apocalypse.
Yes, this is the final of our three parts on contagion in the social imaginary. It might not be the final one. Let's be fair. This pandemic is going to go on for a while.
But today we're going to be talking about movies that are post-apocalyptic, where the apocalypse was caused by some kind of disease.
Rebecca.
Yes?
It's our 100th.
I know. Happy anniversary. I mean, it's not really an anniversary because it's a certain number of episodes.
We did it!
This is our 100th episode together.
Amazing.
Virtual amazing. High five.
Bam. Yay. So I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Because for some of our listeners know that the first 10 episodes of The Sauce were Rebecca with another co-host. Mm-hmm. And then the other co-host got
Rosie Marks.
She got very busy with all of her many fabulous things that she does. And Rebecca asked me, and I... Why me? Why'd you ask me? Why me?
That is a wonderful question. So when Rosie got too busy with her writing and couldn't continue, I started sort of creating a list of people I know who I thought would be good. And I'm not sure, but I think it was like, who do I know who can talk about stuff intelligently and with a sense of humor? So you were definitely on that list. And when it came down to it, I thought that you were the only person I asked. I want you to know you weren't like a second choice or anything.
I was about to ask that, actually.
I've always thought we had a good chemistry when it comes to this kind of thing. I mean, I remember even in high school, I remember feeling like when we got together and started talking about stuff, we went to interesting places. So I wanted to bring a little of that onto the show.
Well, I think that you did a very great thing. And I'm very excited that
I agree.
I think you did a great thing.
You are a great thing.
No, because we are a great thing together, is what I'm saying.
There we go. Yeah. We're like the Voltron of ruining stuff people love. When we unite our powers.
Oh, it's dangerous. So you wrote on our little planning document, should we have a week of commemoration? I kind of think we should.
I was just thinking we could like tweet some of our most listened to episodes.
Absolutely.
We could have some surveys. What are listeners' favorite episodes? They could vote.
Awesome.
Maybe we could revisit some of our personal favorites.
That sounds great. That sounds
great. Just to commemorate the last 100 episodes.
100 episodes.
Just jabbering on.
We did a century. So how are you doing and what are you drinking?
I'm drinking, it's kind of a Coke Americano spritz.
Okay.
It's Coke Americano with some fresh orange juice, fresh lemon juice, and soda. Just sparkling water. I wanted something refreshing because it's hot as fuck right now. It's just like disgusting New York summer right now. So
I love disgusting New York summers. You don't have to wear any clothes at any time of the day or night. I found this bottle of Hacienda Milan. It's crema de chocolate al agave. It's basically...
Oh, God, no.
Tequila chocolate.
Yeah. It's like a creamy, opaque type of liqueur, kind of like a Bailey's.
Yes.
But tequila. Made from agave with chocolate. Yeah.
So I'm making basically a boozy version of like an egg cream
where I'm That's fantastic.
Having it with soda and like a little touch of half and half. And it's quite good.
That sounds delicious. The reason I reacted is
with such horror.
I've had bad experiences in the long term with similar types of liqueurs. You know, they're great going down. It's just, you got to be careful with them because they don't mix well with really life.
Okay. So you're saying that the fact that I had the first one so quickly is a warning.
You want to take it carefully.
And I want to take it really slow. All right, guys, let's see if I can make it through the next hour. And other than booze, how's you? How's you been?
I'm doing fine. We're still in quarantine. It's just being inside and trying not to go crazy all the time. It's loosening up here in New York. We went out to dinner. I'll share that.
What?
As part of the phase two of reopening in New York, we can now have dining outside. So we were able to sit down at a table. They had a no-touch menu. You scan a QR code so you could see the menu on your phone. Yeah. Social distancing. The tables were a certain amount apart. All outside. It was fucking fantastic. It has been so long since we've... Like, going out to dinner is my favorite fucking thing. For me and Matt, that is just our favorite thing to do. And it has been so long. So it was really nice.
Wow. That sounds so good. You see, the numbers are just going back up in LA. So that shit is not happening.
You're in bad shape over there.
We're not doing so well. And I think part of it, I think, are all the people who were like, the only people who are dying are people in nursing homes. Those are the only people getting it. We don't have to worry about this shit. And it's like, motherfucker, you worry about this shit now so we don't be in the situation that we're in now. Like, worry about it when it's in the nursing homes so that you don't have to worry about it in 3 months. Yeah, worry about it now. So now it actually is starting to like spread after months that so many of us have been sheltering in place. It's so frustrating. It's so frustrating because I feel like we've been so good and now we're going to have to keep doing this. And
I know. There's no reprieve. Oh, God.
So, you know, we're all right. We're all right.
Okay, let's get into these post-apocalypse disease movies. We've watched a bunch. We watched 12 Monkeys, which we're going to talk about later, and three versions of the same novel that a few months ago I did not even know were three versions of the same novel. The book was called I Am Legend, a title people probably be familiar with if they recall the Will Smith movie that was one of the ones we watched. I Am Legend came out in 1954, and it's a post-apocalyptic horror novel about a world that has been decimated, completely destroyed by some kind of virus that has turned people into essentially vampires. And this one guy, Robert Neville, is the one survivor.
Right.
Now, the first adaptation that we watched was called The Last Man on Earth, which is a Vincent Price adaptation that came out in 1964. Then we watched The Omega Man.
Oh my God.
The classic 1971 Charlton Heston version. And of course, I Am Legend, the 2007 Will Smith iteration of the tale. We selected these in part because this is just a really good example of a disease post-apocalypse movie. But also because the three versions, I think, provide a great opportunity to look sort of across the decades and the different ways that this specific story has seemed to resonate and the ways that the interpretations of it have changed.
And I think 28 Days Later is very much based on this. I mean, the opening scenes of all of these movies are the last remaining human walking through the dead, empty streets of his city. He is the only one left. There are cars everywhere. Everything ended just right in the middle of things. And he's making a life. He's making a life out of the ruins of civilization. And I think that's very common. That's a convention that has been used a lot.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that Last Man on Earth was the first one to even do that, but it clearly had an influence on 28 Days Later and other disease apocalypse movies.
Yes.
Because, of course, 28 Days Later also has the concept of it's not just that everyone's dead, it's that there are these monsters that have been created by the infection.
By the man-made infection.
Yes, the man-made infection. Though in the novel, it's not man-made, I don't believe. I haven't read the novel. I read the Wikipedia summary. But anyway, we included 28 Days Later in the category of horror rather than post-apocalypse because it is kind of a zombie movie. I mean, obviously there's overlap and these genres are all would be considered horror, I think. And spoiler alert, if you haven't seen 28 Days Later, it's not actually post-apocalypse. That's the big twist.
Just feels like it for a second.
Yeah. And so it plays upon what you have seen before in these apocalypse movies to lead you to understand that it is an apocalypse. And there's also a twist at the end of I Am Legend, which I want to mention off the top so we can look at how the different movies handle it.
Yes.
In the book, the main character, who appears to be the last surviving human on Earth, goes around all day killing these effectively vampires. Then at some point, he meets this woman who is sort of like half a vampire. And he finds out that not everyone with the infection is a complete, like, mindless killer. And some of them are leading lives and actually trying to sort of rebuild society. And they've even found a medication that keeps their symptoms in check. And so they are making a go of it. And he's been going around killing them. And he even killed this woman's husband. And so ultimately, he realizes that he is a monster to them. And that is the source of the title, I Am Legend. As vampires were legends until they became a real thing via disease, so he is now going to be the legend of their new society. He is like the boogeyman, the monster who kills them in their sleep and, you know, they use to terrify their children.
Right, right.
What a twist.
That's the twist, right? Mm-hmm. Let's start with the first version of the movie. And let's do it quickly because I actually feel like it only got interesting in comparison with the subsequent versions.
I mean, I guess that's fair. It's a Vincent Price movie. It's not a great movie.
It's a B movie for sure.
Yeah. So I do want to start with a few of the things that jumped out to me about Last Man on Earth. One of them is Vincent Price himself and this quality he has. He's kind of playing like a regular guy, although he is a scientist in the story. I just can never believe, like, his enunciation, the way he pronounces things, the way he holds himself. He's always Vincent Price.
Yes.
He doesn't seem plausible to me as this, like, family man.
Not even a little bit. Not even slightly. Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. And there's also a lot of that kind of stilted 1964 stagey kind of stuff happening. Like, he's wearing a full suit with like a vest and a tie when his wife dies and he goes out to bury her. And he, on his own, digs a grave, puts her in, buries her completely without ever taking off his jacket or tie, even rolling up his sleeves, you know?
I know. But then there's also this thing where they don't trust that the visual of the things he does every day will tell the story. So you have that voiceover.
Yeah.
I wake up and then I eat breakfast. Yeah. And then I sharpen my stakes to kill the vampire. And it's so, like, it's agonizing. And I think that the central thing that he's trying to play is being so agonized that he's alone. Like, his despair of being the last man is like the central sort of topic. It's like that's what he is, this poor guy who's left alone and with that very ponderous voiceover. It's like, oh my God. It's a little much.
That is really the overriding feeling of that one. He treats his role of killing these infected as this solemn duty. He just has to do it as his responsibility. There's also, though, weirdly, in contrast to that, like, ponderousness and staginess and stiltedness, there are moments where it feels weirdly frank and real. Like, the little daughter dies. Children never die in movies, and his little daughter dies. A lot of the flashbacks to the period of time when everyone's dying and it's really awful, there are moments that the movie does not flinch away from things that you would think it would. I was particularly struck by a moment where his daughter has died and the authorities have come to take away her body because they're burning the bodies. And he finds the truck where her body is and he says to the workman, you know, "That's my daughter in there." And the guy says, "Lots of people's daughters are in there." And I thought there was something very weirdly frank about that.
Yeah. Where all of a sudden these bodies don't get to be people anymore. They're just sources of infection that have to be destroyed.
Exactly. But on the whole, it's a pretty weird and silly little movie.
It is. But you only really understand it when you then look at Omega Man.
I agree. Before we move on to Omega Man, I just want to mention the ending of Last Man on Earth, because it is the one that is closest to the novel of the three. So in Last Man on Earth, he meets this woman. She's infected, but instead of it being like a different strain of infection or whatever, she's part of some society where they keep their infection in check via this medication they've invented. And they all hate him because he has killed their loved ones, not realizing that they're only sort of half infected, that they're still, you know, in control of their minds and they're not violent beasts. So he discovers that he can cure her through using his own blood. But before he's able to share the cure, her cohorts, her group of people, her new society come and kill him. Because he's the monster to them. And Vincent Price sort of realizes in his dying moments, I was the monster. All along.
They were
afraid of me.
Yeah. And then she goes up to a little baby, and you get the sense because they're still, you know, reproducing. And she's like,
yeah.
Because now her blood can be used to save everybody else.
Yeah, that's true. Though, I do think, they could still probably use his. I mean, they just killed him. So let's talk about Omega Man, the absolute classic.
My God. Charlton Heston.
1971. Yeah, Charlton Heston at his, I would say, Hestoniest.
Oh, most Hestony. Okay, so everything about the first movie where it's like, it's emotional, it's painful, this person is left alone, missing his wife, missing his daughter, being so alone, like all that is gone. And you just have this like tough guy. Like the masculinity issues that this movie has are they're unbelievable.
It's crazy. There are some of the motifs. Major motifs definitely are there, like the empty city that we talked about and survival, that last man on his own sort of picking through the remains of society. There are no boundaries or rules during the day. This is a whole thing, right? Because they're sort of vampires, at least originally. The day he sort of can move around and do what he wants. He can go into whatever store, get what he needs. And there is a kind of fascination with that idea in all the movies.
Yes.
But by night, he has to hole up in his home and protect himself because that's when the monsters come out, the infected anyway. So those are the clear similarities. Omega Man makes some distinct changes. One of them being that the disease is now an actual biological weapon.
Yes.
It's very Cold War. There's some sort of conflict between China and Russia, and this biological weapon came out of that. Did the Russians make it? Did the Chinese? Who knows?
Right.
Certainly we weren't involved. And yet we have to suffer.
The Americans always do. God.
There's a lot of taking the story and bringing it in touch with those Cold War fears about nuclear annihilation. It's just a different kind of annihilation and the aftermath of that.
But also in The Last Man on Earth, the dead people, or the undead, rather, they're kind of just your normal undead. They're not that fast.
Yeah.
They're not that dangerous.
They lumber around.
They love, Robert, you know,
they're
like
typical zombies.
And in Omega Man, this weird new group of infected people are like a cult.
Yes.
They're like a cult. Like, that's what happens to them. Like, you get infected and you immediately join the cult.
So the infected people are characterized by sort of albinism. They're completely white skinned. Their hair is white. Their eyes are super light blue, almost white.
They're immediately in a robe. I don't know. You get sick and immediately you find yourself
issued
in
a robe with a hood.
Yeah.
That's just what happens in this scenario. But they don't lumber around or really behave differently or speak differently from regular humans. The main difference is how they look, and apparently they're sort of allergic to light. Light sort of pains them.
Yes.
They prefer the dark. They see better in the dark. It's just whatever. Yes. Regular folks find to be their reactions to light and dark.
They are nocturnal. They are nocturnal. Like, that seems to be like the,
that's,
you know,
the essence. Yeah, they're nocturnal. But they converse with each other. They talk in normal ways, except the content of what they're saying, which is some kind of new agey, cult-like. They also use kind of like jive talk a little bit. It's maybe drawing upon the youth culture of the time a little bit, the way they talk.
Which brings us to this moment that happens early in the movie. In all of these movies, the movies open very much with the like strategy of how you fill a day when you're the last person on Earth.
Yes.
This is how you go. This is the procedure. It's like very procedural in nature. It's like you wake up. This is how you manage breakfast. This is how you manage making sure your car has gas. This is how you manage killing zombies. Like, it's very, this is the structure of a day. And part of Charlton Heston's character, part of the structure of his day, is going to the movie theater and watching the movie Woodstock.
Yes.
Like, that's what he does every day, is go to the movie theater and, like, use the fuel to, like, make the generators go so that he can watch Woodstock.
The implication is that that was the movie that was in the theater when everything went to shit. So it's the movie he can watch. It's the 70s, so he doesn't have a VCR or whatever. He has to watch what's there. So right off the bat, and this is like the first 5 minutes of the movie, it establishes really clearly this attitude of, look at these dumb-ass hippies. They thought they were going to make the world a better place. They thought they were going to bring peace and love and all this shit. And look, they didn't have any answer for it when the Ruskies and or the Chinese unleashed a deadly weapon. They didn't get it.
And then it connects to the fact that this new class of bizarre creatures are like the hippies. They're like cultists.
Yes.
And one of the weird moments, because there's a lot of weird shit in this movie, and I have to say, I have to bring this up because I think this is going to help us. It was when he was making this movie that Charlton Heston became a Second Amendment nut. Like, this is when all the gun stuff started happening for him.
I mean, it makes a weird amount of sense. The movie opens with him driving around in a convertible and just shooting shit up. And yeah.
At one point, one of the cult members who in his non-zombie life was black says something like, calls Charlton Heston's character a honky.
Mm-hmm,
and the cult leader is like, we don't do that anymore. So it's like, part of what makes this new cult of zombies bad is that they're post-racial. It's like, there's something very fucking weird going on.
Well, what makes them bad is that they reject everything having to do with the former society. Their whole sort of ethic, their whole ideology is based around the idea that the disease was visited upon humans for their sins, basically, right?
Right.
That this was a punishment for a society gone wrong.
Yes.
And the survivors now, and by survivors, I mean these infected people with the white skin, they now bear the mark of this, and their job is to live a technology-free existence.
Yes.
They're anti-technology.
Yes.
And apparently when you get infected, it just makes you agree with this. You're like, yes, this makes sense to me now. And you join this cult, this anti-technology cult, and they really want to kill Charlton Heston.
Yes.
Because I guess, you know, he uses electricity, keeps lights on, which they hate because lights yes. give them pain, which actually makes a certain amount of sense. But because he clings to the ways of the previous society, he represents someone who's not accepting the punishment that he was due.
Yes. So that's the thing. It's like Luddites are bad. Hippies are bad.
Oh, yes.
These people are these anti-capitalist. They're essentially mm-hmm. like anti-capitalist hippies. And that is clearly meant to be really bad.
The real disease is hippies.
Yes. The real disease is hippies with their anti-progress stance, essentially.
Exactly.
And masculinity, I've got to say, masculinity is a big problem here. I'm sorry.
Well, there's so many moments where Charlton Heston like has his shirt off.
He's the only character in all three of these movies who doesn't seem to have any kind of personal loss.
Yeah, there's no wife or child. Yeah.
There's no wife or child. There's no sadness. There's no like, God, I'm so lonely. He just says like really sardonic, sarcastic shit all the time. Like he doesn't mind being the only person left. He must have produced it because there's such insane masculinity wish fulfillment.
Oh,
he's supposed to be super sexy, even though he's kind of getting a little old. Like, he doesn't look great. And there's this other character in it because he finds a couple of people who aren't infected. And one of them is this, like, young scientist. And the young scientist is, like, legit hot. But Charlton Heston, you can tell he, not as a character, as an actor, he really thinks he's the sexy guy in the movie. And you're but you're not. You're not.
No, but you are judging sexiness through a hippie point of view.
That's
true. You see the young hip guy as being sexy, not the old craggy gun toter.
I know. That's really my problem.
It is your problem, right?
That's, yeah.
The thing that struck me is there's a moment near the end where I really thought maybe it was going to have the I Am Legend ending or some version of that.
Right.
Because there's this young kid who is a member of this group of people who are like only partially infected because this infection, whatever, does whatever it feels like doing for the purposes of the plot. Some people don't die. Some people don't turn into white skinned, whatever. And this kid is saying, I'm going to go to the leader of the infected and talk to him. I'm just going to talk to him. I'm going to tell him, we'll leave. You do your thing. We'll do our thing.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. And Charlton Heston's like, that's not a good idea. Don't do that. And I thought the movie has this opportunity to show Charlton Heston having been wrong this whole time. That in fact, if he had just talked to them, it would be fine. But the kid goes and talks to them and they kill him.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
And the lesson is that thinking you could talk to these people is just hopelessly, tragically naive.
That's right.
Like, only a child,
yes,
a stupid child at that, would think that you could talk this out and have a peaceful resolution. And now look at him. He's dead.
Yeah.
You can't reason with these people, these hippies.
But it's also like not just a child. Back to the race thing, like a stupid black child. Like there's something so infantilizing about it. Like,
oh,
and there's something so racist about this movie. And yet the woman who appears is black. It's her brother. She's, as they sort of have her brother who's turning into a vampire on this like IV drip in the next room, she decides that what she really wants is to fuck Charlton Heston. Wish fulfillment, Chucky. Like, I don't fucking think so. I don't think she's gorgeous. She's totally badass. And
beautiful young woman. Yeah.
But there, come on. Come on.
But I think it's deliberate. Charlton Heston, the filmmakers are trying to portray him as hip. Don't get this wrong. He's not a square. He's cool with the black. He doesn't care. He doesn't care that she's black. It doesn't even come up.
It's just that his version of reality, which is a totally white supremacist reality, is just the right one. It's exactly. just the right one.
Exactly, exactly.
It's not his fault that it's just the right one, that he's right and not wrong about yeah. anything.
And he's sarcastic about everything and has no attachments, because you can't have attachments and care about shit and really be macho. He has to be the pinnacle of macho. And, of course, he has to sacrifice himself in the end.
Right.
Because right. that's like the ultimate macho. It's the ultimate in infantilizing and paternalizing. He gets killed by the infected in order to save the semi-infected. Now that he's found a cure for them, because that's the yeah, thing. His blood is a cure.
Well, they're all scientists. I mean, yeah.
yeah.
So, yeah, basically what it comes down to is that you see all of the roots of the contemporary conservative Second Amendment, like, issues of masculinity in this movie. Like, it is
it's all there.
It's such a bizarre time capsule.
It is very much. Finally, we have to talk about I Am Legend, which yes. I think, whatever, it's a mediocre kind of horror movie of the mid-2000s, but I think it makes a really interesting contrast with Omega Man, because it borrows so much from Omega Man. It's much more a remake of that than it is an adaptation of the book, I Am Legend.
Yes, but also it goes back, I think it takes things from the first two movies. So you have Will Smith, I mean, first of all, Will Smith, of the three actors, is the one who's the most a star. It is a vehicle for him.
Yes, you know, absolutely.
He lost his wife and child. He's tormented by that throughout the movie. He is also a scientist, but he's the one who's the most engaged in the process of trying to cure the disease, continuing to fix this disease.
Absolutely. So that's like the thing that struck me the most is he's in the military, which Charlton Heston's character was also in the military. And he's also a scientist, as the previous two versions of the character were scientists. But in this case, he does not go around killing infected people. Like, he just doesn't do that. He sincerely wants to cure them. He feels guilty that he didn't find a cure before everything and everyone died. He's still trying to save the world. It's like a kinder, gentler, softer version of masculinity. It's yes. still masculinity, but it's a caring type. It's where he wants to fix things.
It's the most, I mean, use the word, and I think it's the most precise. It's the most paternalistic.
It's incredibly paternalistic. He sees it as his responsibility.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
To save everyone. He, like Vincent Price in the first version, had a wife and a daughter who got killed, and that's a big part of what's driving him, and that feeds into the whole impression of paternalism. It's all about his failure to protect his family, to
that's
protect
right.
the world.
That's right.
That's what he's driven by. And as in the other movies, you have the scenes of the empty city.
But also, that one was the movie that had the most idea of the kind of, like, killing of humans equals a return to nature. All of a sudden, yes. New York is full of all of these, like, deer.
Wild
and, like,
animals.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is an important visual motif, too.
Yes.
So, I Am Legend comes close to hitting on at least the spirit of the original ending of the novel. Because apparently there's an alternate ending, and apparently it was the original ending, but the filmmakers decided to change it at the last moment. And it's really a very interesting choice. Long story short, all of the infected monsters come to his house. They find where he lives. They attack him. And he winds up with this other non-infected woman and her child who he has encountered. And they are stuck in his basement laboratory behind glass. The leader of the infected is banging on the glass, getting ready to break through. In the theatrical ending, Will Smith sacrifices himself, as Charlton Heston did, sacrifices himself so the woman and her son can get away. And they do make it up to Vermont, where there's a colony of humans living
yes. in
a walled community where they're safe, at least for now. Oh, and also they have the cure, because he just before that, he realizes that the cure he's been working on, the last iteration of it, has worked.
So she gets to the new commune of saved humans with the mm-hmm. cure, because
yes.
he...
Because he did that.
He did that.
So, in the original ending, I mean, the what is now the alternate ending, the leader of the infected is banging on the glass, getting ready to break through. Will Smith realizes that he has created, the monster has created a butterfly shape on the glass. Will Smith recognizes that as the butterfly tattoo on the arm of the female monster he's been experimenting on, and realizes that the dude is just there for his girlfriend. So he sheepishly walks out and says, I didn't realize. He apologizes. He sets her free. And the monsters all just leave, having accepted Will Smith's apology. He now realizes that he's been wrong to experiment on them.
Yes.
This whole time, they were thinking and feeling creatures, not the mindless monsters he thought they were. What happens after that?
They escape the city. He and the woman in the city are on their way to Vermont, on their way to the new commune.
They go
also with the cure. But he feels bad for having experimented on all of these creatures.
Right.
Because he killed them. He killed them in experimenting.
Yeah, he killed many of them.
Yes.
So that ending at least got somewhere adjacent to the idea that he was kind of the monster to them.
Yes.
That they didn't want to kill him just because they kill. They hated him because he did these horrible things to their people. But the studio jettisoned that, whoever was involved in this decision jettisoned that, and they preferred the idea that the meaning of I Am Legend should be that he is this legendary self-sacrificer who gave his life to allow the cure to be distributed.
He was, so they went for the Jesus ending.
Yes.
Because as stories go, it's a pretty great story. So I think that
some have called it a good story.
Yeah. A good one. So in all three of them, you have these empty city streets. And I think the point that I wanted to just bring up as we move into 12 Monkeys and then in sort of the whole range of disease movies that we're looking at is that the problem isn't the disease. The disease right. is the thing that broke society. And one of the things about them walking through these empty streets and these abandoned streets is that it's almost like, God, when the apocalypse comes, our world is going to look so stupid. Like, we're going to look so fucking dumb. Like, mannequins in windows and cartoons and weird food items and, like, all of this sort of consumerist society that we live in. That, God, when the end of the world comes, we're going to look so stupid.
Yes. But also, the infected in these movies represent chaos and the total lack of social structure, or at least the social structures of the former world, the old world, right?
Yes.
They're barbaric.
Yes.
They're anti-progress in their various ways. And there is there's a certain level of fantasy in being this one last holdout against the decivilizing forces. Yes, the shallow shit looks stupid at this point. How trivial were we that we were buying high-heeled shoes and, you know, wasting our time with these superficial things, because, you know, now to survive, that's this fantasy of survivalism, right?
Yes.
But it's also one thing that all three characters in all three movies have in common is that they do hold on to the old ways of existing. They have electricity. They live in the way that they used to as much as they can.
Yep.
It does seem to be some kind of fantasy of resisting these decivilizing forces, you know, maintaining the integrity of the old society, even if you're the one person doing it alone.
Another movie that isn't a direct adaptation, but another sort of post-apocalyptic disease movie with the human-made disease, blah, 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 is the Terry Gilliam movie 12 Monkeys.
I have to say, before we get into our interpretations, on rewatching it, I probably haven't seen it in 20 years. It was simultaneously a lot better and a lot worse than I remember. Yeah.
In what ways was it better?
Well, it's so Terry Gilliam. Visually, you know, he always brings his A game. He's always creating really interesting visual motifs, visual and thematic motifs that run through, like monkeys and like disease and infection as themes, and things fit together really nicely in lovely ways. At the same time, there's some real problems with, like, Bruce Willis's character, Madeline Stowe's character, and the way she responds to him. And there's some gender issues, like, really bad gender issues, I think.
You know where I saw the gender issues? Is just in the listing of all the actors in the opening of the movie, where it's like, you know how they, like, starring this person with this person, and then they have this group of five actors and this group of three actors, and it sort of goes on and on and on. Yeah. They were all men. And I was
a lot of boys.
There are no women anywhere except for Madeline. So, like, that's it. It's all men.
So I want to get into it.
Yes.
In terms of its connection to the other ones we're talking about, it does start out with some of the same visual motifs. You have Bruce Willis in the empty Philadelphia. It's covered in snow, but it's been abandoned. You have zoo animals sort of running wild, living wild in the city, in the remains. You have empty stores with things that seem now trivial and silly, like, you know, women's bags and shoes and things like that. So this idea of the ruins of civilization and the superficiality and triviality of consumerism, those are right there. In this story, in case you're unfamiliar, I feel like this movie is like 20 years old, so go see it if you haven't. But it takes place in a world where disease has destroyed humanity, basically, and the remnants of humanity live underground. And Bruce Willis is a prisoner. He's committed some kind of crime within this new underground society. And they force him to, quote-unquote, volunteer to travel through time to try to investigate the origins of the disease. Because somehow they think if they can find out the origins of it, they might be able to fix things so that people can go back to the surface and live on the surface as before. So right off the bat, I'm like, wait a minute. They don't really mean disease. They mean contamination.
Yes.
Because living underground isn't going to prevent disease. You're going to be enclosed spaces without good ventilation. You're going to just spread disease.
Yes.
And Bruce Willis's character throughout the movie talks repeatedly about the air. When he goes back to 1990 and 1996, he's talking about how great the air is. So there's their conception of disease in the movie is a contamination in the air, which is interesting. And it is human-made, as you mentioned. And it is fundamentally like a disruption. That's what matters. Not that it's a disease or what it does to you. You never really find that out. But that it disrupts society so completely that it paves the way for totalitarianism that exists in the future. It's not completely sketched out. You don't know all the contours of this new society, but their legal code is called like the permanent emergency code or something like that. Right.
But also, like, everything is disrupted and yet you can time travel? I mean, that's like,
well,
they haven't been able to solve like other things, but they have
figured out this virus.
But they figured out time travel.
Definitely figured out time travel. In this really almost steampunkish, but more like 1920s, 30s, it's got like an Art Deco-y scientist feel. All their technology is retro technology.
Yes.
And Terry Gilliam seems a lot more interested in making analogies between contemporary society and this futuristic totalitarian society than in actually creating any sort of realistic depiction of a post-apocalypse, a disease post-apocalypse.
Right.
He visually goes out of his way to show you that the prison that Bruce Willis is in the future and the scientists who recruit him to do this task are no different from the mental institution slash prison that he's in 1990 and the doctors who run that.
Yes.
It's a Terry Gilliam movie. He's going to want to tear down any kind of institution or authority.
Yes.
And it's really interesting to me that it's doctors and scientists in this case who are representing this authority that he's so right. skeptical of.
Right.
Okay, so the theme of infection actually kind of plays an interesting role. You have, in 1990, Bruce Willis gets institutionalized because he's going around telling everyone that there's going to be this disease and everyone's going to die.
Right.
So they put him in a mental institution with Brad Pitt.
Who is so good.
He's great.
He's great. So fucking good. Oh, it's too much.
I thought, you know, I was like, on rewatching this, I'm going to find his performance mannered and like a little too try hard. But you know what? He's great.
He's a great actor. Really good at it. He's a really great actor. What do you want? It's so ridiculous.
I'll go with that. But in his rants that he does, his character talks about madness as a disease. They have to lock us in here so that we don't infect the populace with our plague of madness.
Yes.
And he keeps going back to that idea. What is madness? Germ theory was thought to be madness at first.
Right.
And now you're considered
right.
mad if you don't believe in germ theory. And so clearly, Terry Gilliam's a lot more interested in talking about these issues about, you know, authority and knowledge and the way institutions affect that. And it's also incredibly anti-consumerist, anti-capitalist.
Yes.
And this idea is brought up repeatedly that Bruce Willis appears to be insane because he's predicting
what's happening. Yes.
The destruction of humanity, the apocalypse. Yeah. But what's more insane, predicting the apocalypse or what we're doing right now, which is inevitably going to bring on the apocalypse? We're destroying the environment. Isn't that the real insanity? Like, that question is posed repeatedly. So there's definitely like an environmental sort of message here. It actually seems more interested in that than the concept of disease itself. But it's interesting that disease is the stand-in in this case for that.
Yes. Well, that's also because this wasn't based on I Am Legend. It's based on La Jetée by Chris Marker.
Yes.
And La Jetée is this kind of like beautiful, weird, speculative science fiction movie. Everything is in stills. It's like an experimental film from the 60s. And the thing that's the sort of central idea of it is that this memory that he has turns out to be the event that ends his life. So mm-hmm. the time and going and past and present, and that's what it's kind of about. And in order to expand it, Terry Gilliam had to go to this narrative that's about like disease post-apocalypse. Like, I guess you can't have post-apocalypse without disease in there somewhere, but disease seems to be kind of like a red herring. It's not like...
Well, that's kind of the point is the red herring, but it's the 12 monkeys that's the red herring. He goes on this quest and it turns out that all the clues that the scientists are presenting him with that indicate that this 12 monkeys group was responsible for spreading the disease, all of those clues turn out to be things that he caused.
Yes.
Or things that he comes across in his quest to find the 12 monkeys.
Yes.
And in fact, they're not responsible at all. But let's talk, can we talk about the masculinity thing?
Oh God. Yeah.
Masculinity is clearly a big issue. It's very present in this movie because Madeline Stowe is the only woman, pretty much. The only other woman is one of the scientists in the future, which I want to talk about in a second. But it's striking the way that Madeline Stowe is figured, the way she is presented as the only character who is kind, empathetic. She is calm and gentle. She cares about James. That's Bruce Willis's character.
She doesn't escalate situations.
The police rough him up. The orderlies at the mental institution mistreat him. Everybody around him just sort of like wants to shove him around as the scientists of the future do. They don't listen to him.
Yes.
They don't care about him. They just want to push him around and control him. She's the only person, this soft, lovely woman with the long, wavy hair.
I was about to say, like, the long, wavy hair while she's working. Would yeah. you have, like, the perfect, perfect curls while you're, like, working yeah. in a mental institution? I don't
You'd
know.
You'd want to tie that tie, shit back.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's very
yeah.
grabbable. Yeah. yeah, but no, no one's going to grab her hair because she's kind and soft. And she isn't afraid of him. She feels no. bad for him.
That's right.
He, through his relationship with her, becomes more and more childlike. He starts to question and not understand what's real and what's not. And that's sort of part of the plot.
Yes.
He's been given drugs by the mental institution. He's been shunted back and forth in time in disorienting ways. He starts to think maybe he's insane.
But also, he's being made to do this. It's not like yeah. anybody who's a prisoner has a choice. You just are like volunteered for this incredibly dangerous...
Yeah.
Yeah.
The point being that he becomes infantilized across the movie and he,
yes.
she for him is this like mommy lover doctor figure. And I found that very interesting and disturbing, especially in contrast to the future scientist woman who is very harsh and severe. She has straight, short, harsh hair and her face looks, as is not unusual in Terry Gilliam movies, her face looks like she's had plastic surgery, like it's kind of fake. And she turns out, in the end, to sort of ambiguously, but in my interpretation, she's the villain.
Right.
The guy who's actually spreading the disease winds up getting on a plane, and she's sitting next to him as her 1996 self, and says that she's in insurance. And I interpreted that as... she's been sending him on a goose chase because she doesn't want him to find out the truth of how the disease was perpetrated because she right. was involved.
Right.
So she's evil and she's also kind of unfeminine.
Right. Well, I mean, I feel like it's interesting just because we're in this moment of people responding to the horrors of white supremacy and masculinity and what it's done to our entire planet. And we're in this sort of like capitalist collapse moment. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that all of these post-apocalyptic movies with all of these men, these really important men, it's almost like this massive guilt reaction.
Yes, but they never really acknowledge having been the monster. The closest you get is right. the Vincent Price version.
That's right.
Where... it's like it was all a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
If they had only stopped to listen, they would know he could cure them. The others really go toward this idea of him as essentially a hero, a self-sacrificing hero in many cases. And in 12 Monkeys, he does die. He doesn't die to save humanity, though.
No.
Which is interesting. He dies in this sort of time loop that he is caught in.
Yes.
And... the film is very much talking about how you can't change the past. The impossibility of changing the past, it's kind of fatalistic in predicting the apocalypse, saying this can't be avoided. We are on this path. Humanity is bound to destroy itself.
And the female, I'm sorry, I've just been reading mm-hmm. Sylvia Federici's Caliban and the Witch.
Oh, okay.
Which is this really amazing history theory book that's about the ways that capitalism could not have happened without a brutal terrorist misogyny towards women, mm-hmm, without mm-hmm. women becoming a certain thing. Like the machine of capitalism can't run unless women exist in society in a certain way. And the roots of our present-day misogyny are the roots of capitalism. And that with we used to have the commons, the sort of lands that all people had in common. And that when the commons got enclosed by rich, wealthy people, women's bodies became the commons. Because that's how you can sort of control the working man, is by having women become their commons and then have women reproduce more labor for mm-hmm. this capitalist system to work.
Yes.
So I was thinking a lot about that when I was watching 12 Monkeys. Because even the version of femininity that Madeline Stowe's character possesses is this very capitalist version of what women are supposed to be. And that's one of the things that, like, Sylvia Federici traces, that in the years where there were witch hunts and they were destroying women and trying to terrorize any kind of power that they had out of them, women were shrews and awful and nags. And then once they really managed to get women in their place by terrorizing them enough, women are passive and they're meant, they like being at home. Like, of those things are just constructions.
Yes. And that fits really interestingly with the references in 12 Monkeys to Vertigo, to Hitchcock's Vertigo. At one point, they're hiding out in a movie theater and the movie Vertigo is on. And Bruce Willis even says, this is just like us, because it's that great scene when they're in Muir Woods.
Yes.
And she's looking at the cut out piece of the redwood and
how the tree
was labeled for the different rings and what time period of history they represent. And she's like, here I was born and here I died, you know. And he says, that's just like us, because he's remembering his own death throughout the movie. And okay, it's analogous. But think about Vertigo and what that movie was about. This man obsessed with this woman who was not real.
Yes.
But he finds her and makes her into the unreal woman that he wants her to be, the Hitchcockian blonde.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
And then in fucking 12 Monkeys, she goes and bleaches her hair as part of their disguise because he's wanted by the police. And
in the
following scene after the theater, her hair's all styled kind of like retro.
Yes.
And there's even like a little bit of the music from the movie and Vertigo in the background as the camera dollies in on her and her new icy blonde look.
Yes.
It's very explicit in its making that reference.
Not subtle.
Yeah, it's not subtle. But what does that reference mean? It's not just about memory and unreliability of it. It's also about psychosexual obsession.
Yes.
With a woman onto whom you are projecting things.
Yes.
And making her be some sort of canvas for what you need.
Well, which is why at the end of the day, it almost didn't matter whether she was there or not, because she has no power. She's just not a part of that story at all. All she is is like just an object for you. But it's not like she has any kind of agency that can help move this story one way or another. Because she doesn't.
Exactly. She doesn't. She's just there for him to get violent in order to protect her.
Yeah.
Because, again, there's a kind of paternalism. He's very strong. He's described as being able to take down a whole bunch of cops. And he has no weapons because he's future strong. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he only uses that to protect her.
Of course.
His mommy lover.
His
doctor,
mommy lover, lady. Doctor, ideal, the woman who's
ideal
going to.
Ideal Kim Novak.
Yeah, the ideal woman. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Rebecca?
Maya?
What did we learn?
What have we learned on this journey?
Through all of these movies, because this is like three episodes that we've done about representations of disease.
We've learned that the contagion was within us all along. No. So we've looked at...
You're the monster.
Yeah, right? We've looked at dramas, straight dramas and action movies about disease and contagion.
Yes.
We've looked at horror movies about disease and contagion.
Yes.
And we've looked at post-apocalypse movies about disease and contagion.
Yes.
So what are the through lines? What do we take away from this about the way that disease figures in at least the American cultural imagination as manifested through these Hollywood movies?
So I feel like this thing that you wrote down, because you're very smart, is that
thank you.
Disease is not the thing that we're afraid of. What we're afraid of is what disease is going to reveal about what we are.
Or what disease is going to cause to happen.
Yes.
Which fundamentally goes to that, to what we really are. Because disease is going to cause breakdown in our social structures or government institutions. And that will reveal that underneath this thin veneer of civilization and structure and democracy, we aren't really like that. Underneath, we are,
we're monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is a big through line that it's in almost all of them, is this idea that the contagion is going to cause the breakdown of our institutions.
But also the institutions are so often the cause of it. And that's what I think is sort of interesting, is that like, it's going to cause a breakdown of our institutions, but it's all of those institutions that made this happen in the first place. Yeah. So it's almost like the disease is the problem and it's the solution and it's what it always was. Like, they were making the diseases. They were producing the diseases.
Even in like Contagion, where it's not made in a lab, it is revealed that it's environmental destruction created the situation that allowed the disease to come into being. So, yes, society, the way we live now, is going to create this disease. And then the situation created by the disease allows those worst parts of society that caused it to gain supremacy and become dominant.
So we're all headed towards destruction. And then why does it take the shape of a disease and not like just like war or something? It's like, it's really important that it's a disease. And I think a lot of that comes to stuff that I was looking at our list of themes of the earlier movies, like you are not you. Bad things are happening to your body. Taboos are crossed as part of infection. Like, there's the institutional failure and the ways that in some ways the institutional failures were seeded in the institutions all along. But then there's the fear of what it's going to do to your body.
Yes. Although I will say that the body horror element is not common. That's actually sort of a smaller subcategory here, and it's very specific. The minority of these movies involve body horror, though that is a thing, and we're talking about. But I think that body horror is a piece of the bigger picture of violation, personal violation. Your home, your space gets violated, your body gets violated, gets invaded. Invasion is a really big theme. And then, like, your identity, your ability to have agency and be who you are gets violated. All of those things are prominent in a lot of these movies. And then, of course, your rights get violated. There's a big theme of totalitarianism. Even in the action-adventure versions, like Outbreak, you see the government taking a heavy hand, the military stepping in, you know, quarantine. They come in and take over your town or your building or whatever it might be, and you lose your individuality, not just like the disease might make you not who you are, but you lose your individuality in the sense of mattering. You don't matter anymore. They're just going to cut off your community and bomb you.
So this is – but here's the thing. This is why I think all of these movies – this goes back to the Federici. I feel like all of these movies are the white male suprematist fear of being irrelevant. I feel like one of the things that's so fascinating about this moment that we're in right now – and one of my husband's friends said, the reason that there are so many marches right now is because there are no sports to be the opiate of the masses. Like, they're like, there's no sports. And so we're like all out on the street. Like, what is happening with the majority of people in this COVID moment? The majority of people are wearing masks, trying to shelter in place, doing the best that they can. And the only reason that they're going out is to fucking march for the end of white supremacy. And I feel like that is more horrifying to these filmmakers. They want to believe that what would actually happen is the end of society. They're trying to make us believe that it's the end of society, where it's the end of them being in control of society, and no worse horror can be imagined for them. Like, our reality right now looks like, to some white guy, looks like I Am Legend. All these wonderful people marching in the streets wearing masks.
I think the most clear manifestation of this, where we see people in real life today performing what we see in these movies, is people protesting the wearing of masks.
Yes.
People calling masks tyranny.
Yes.
That's what you see again and again in these movies, is the pandemic being the circumstance that allows government tyranny to take over.
Right.
And so they act upon that as if that's actually happening, and their barbershop being shut down, and their restaurant asking them to wear a fucking mask if they're going to come in. This is tyranny. This is that thing that these movies prepped us to be afraid of.
Right.
And they're ready. They're ready to be the last man holding fast to their rights in this time of barbarism.
Yes.
But the majority of people absolutely are like, no, we're going to conduct society because it's fine.
And if this is making us question or challenge anything, it's the structures of inequity that are being revealed and exposed. Like, those are the structures that we're worrying about. And maybe there could be this other way. But I think what's also interesting is that right now, the tyrannical enforcers are not even enforcing anything. There's no leadership from our government right now.
Well, that's another thing, is that the resistance to masks that I was talking about is not some kind of organic thing that just arose from people feeling that way. It's a perverse result of this strange system we have set up, where Trump does whatever the fuck occurs to him because he's a malignant narcissist and has to behave a certain way.
Yes.
And then this whole network of right-wing media and politicians have to find justifications for it and rationalize it, and that filters down to the people, who then have to accept it because their identity is tied up in believing that this is their tribe. So they're like, yeah, masks are bad.
It could as easily
be the opposite. They could be all for masks if that's what they were getting messaged from above. But I do think that it's a funny resonance to see in these movies. In so many of these movies, there's this government tyranny and this, like, it's a dehumanization, the lack of caring about individual people. You stop being an individual person and you just become a disease vector who's going to be quarantined or killed. And that's how these people claim to feel.
Not able to go get
their haircut.
But to them,
wearing a fucking mask,
the equivalent of life and liberty is capitalism. And it's the famous quote, which is ascribed to Zizek, but it wasn't Zizek. People have an easier time imagining the end of the world than they do the end of capitalism.
That's a great quote. Do we know who that was originally from?
It's attributed to Frederick Jameson, and it was popularized by a writer named Mark Fisher, who wrote a book called Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative? There we go.
That pretty much sums it up when you think about Charlton Heston in his apartment, drinking fine whiskey and enjoying all these luxuries.
Yep.
Gotta keep capitalism alive.
That's it.
There is so much more we could have said, but we have to stop at some point. Okay? We have to leave it for now. Listeners, you take it from here.
Yes.
Tell us your thoughts about these films that we've discussed. What other films about disease and contagion have you been watching, or have you seen, that you think could shed light on these questions?
Absolutely. We still love seeing pictures of you in your masks. Please
send
more.
Oh, yes. Please send pictures of you in your masks.
And I have a question that comes from one of our listeners, and we're going to be asking it, I think, for a few weeks. We got a great email from one of our longtime listeners, Marcus Anderson. Mm-hmm. He was like, hey, can you ruin White Saviors? And I was like, yeah, we already have. And he's like, you're right, you did. I went back and listened to that episode. You totally ruined White Saviors. And he said, something you could ruin is how we navigate films that are widely viewed as classics or canon, but are messed up in one way or another. He said that during the Scorsese episode, you like Taxi Driver, and he has a really complicated relationship with Taxi Driver because Travis Bickle is so blatantly racist. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's a really interesting question. Like, in these moments of increased awareness of sexism and of racism, what are faves that you have found ruined or increasingly problematic?
And how do you handle that? How do you deal with realizing how problematic your faves are?
Yeah, like, so that's something that I thought would be a great question to actually hand over to all of our listeners.
Yeah, I would love to hear what listeners think about that.
So for the next couple of weeks, we're going to be asking about, like, what do you do with your, what are your problematic faves? And tell us what they are. You can be like, don't use my name, like we will normally.
Or we will if you want us to use your name.
If you're willing to, but yeah.
Email us, wearesaucepodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram as @saucepodcast.
Find me at Maya Garance, anywhere you're looking for Maya Garances. And also come and follow The Plague Archives at The Plague Archives on Instagram.
You can find me as @GynoStar on all the various platforms. We look forward to hearing from you all.
Problematic faves.
Adios, amoebas.